Good morning, everyone. Greet you in Jesus' name. Good to have everybody here this morning. For a message, I would like to look at a phrase that's used several times in the scriptures. And it's, well, you can turn to the first time. It's used in Genesis chapter 22. I think it's seven or eight passages that we're going to look at that this phrase is used, and I'll just use that as a title, and it's the phrase, "Here I am." Sometimes it's also, "Here am I," but it's easier in our way of speaking to put the verb before the subject before the verb. So sometimes in the Bible it's also translated that way, "Here I am." Now, it was suggested to me, and this is what started my study on this phrase, that this comes from a Hebrew word and that has a certain context to it. Well, I don't know Hebrew, so I have to rely on translations and stuff like that. Well, the interesting thing is when you look this up in Strong's, for instance, you're going to find that the phrase, "Behold," well, let's just read Genesis 22, verse 1, and then I'll talk about it a little bit. "And it came to pass after these things that God did tempt Abraham and said unto him, Abraham, and he said, Behold, here I am." Now, you'll notice this in our English translations. If you have a King James Bible, you're going to see the word "behold" in regular words or like regular type. And then the word "I" is in regular type. But "here" and "am" are italicized. Now, I understand that in the translation process that you can't do every word for word. But whenever the Hebrew has "behold" and "I" together, the translators put "here" and "am" in there to make it work in English. What we're learning here is that the word "behold" is like this whole phrase, "Behold, here am I." If you look in the Hebrew, it's all one word, which is just interesting. And the word has to do with this beholding. So if you look it up, you'll see that sometimes it's translated "behold," and then sometimes it has this "here I am" on the end of it. But it's also translated just a whole bunch of times, just simply "behold." Well, why does that even matter? Well, it's interesting to me because if you think about a man or a person replying to God's call in their life saying "behold," that's interesting, right? What does "behold" mean? What means to look at with intention? We say it sometimes, the Bible says it, you know, "lo and behold," look and see, like look and take notice of this. And so it took my mind to a verse in Isaiah chapter 66, verses 1 and 2. God is speaking, and he says, "Thus saith the Lord, the heaven is my throne, the earth is my footstool. Where is the house that ye build unto me, and where is the place of my rest? For all those things hath my hand made, and all those things have been, saith the Lord. But to this man will I look." This man is the man I'll behold. "Even to him that is poor and of a contrite spirit and trembleth at my word." So now we know who God looks at. So when a man or a woman is responding to God's call and they say, "Behold, here I am," they are inviting God to look at them with intention. Well, God already knew that that's the way that person was going to be. That's why he called him. But anyway, I think that's interesting. And so in the context, what I understand is whenever the word "behold" is used by itself, it means to just simply look. But whenever a person says, "Behold, here I am," it's reflecting the intent to be of use. And to respond in surrender and in faith. And so I would like to just take a little trip through the Bible and look at the times where people responded to God. Now, there are also times, and you'll see it here in this story with Abraham and Isaac, where people respond to people with that phrase. But I'm just picking out the ones where people responded to God's calls in a particular way. So let's read Genesis 22, verses 1 through 13. And I want to just focus on this this phrase and maybe try to learn some things from each of these stories. I already read verse 1. God calls Abraham. Abraham responds, "Here I am." And he said, this is God saying, verse 2, "Take now thy son, thine only son Isaac, whom thou lovest, and get thee into the land of Moriah, and offer him there for a burnt offering upon one of the mountains which I will tell thee of." And Abraham rose up early in the morning and sat on his ass and took two of his young men with him, and Isaac his son, and clave the wood for the burnt offering, and rose up and went into the place of which God had told him. Then on the third day, Abraham lifted up his eyes and saw the place afar off. And Abraham said to his young men, "Abide ye here with the ass, and I and the lad will go yonder and worship and come again to you." And Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it upon Isaac his son. He took the fire in his hand and a knife, and they went both of them together. And Isaac spake unto Abraham his father and said, "My father." And he said, "Here am I, my son." Now there you'll notice that Abraham uses the same phrase in response to Isaac. And he said, Isaac said, "Behold the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for a burnt offering?" And Abraham said, "My son, God will provide himself a lamb for a burnt offering." And so they went, both of them together. And they came to the place which God had told him of. And Abraham built an altar there and laid the wood in order and bound Isaac his son and laid him on the altar upon the wood. And Abraham stretched forth his hand and took the knife to slay his son. And the angel of the Lord called unto him out of heaven and said, "Abraham, Abraham." And he said, "Here am I." And he said, "Lay not thine hand upon the lad, neither do thou anything unto him. For now I know that thou fearest God, seeing thou hast not withheld thy son, thine only son, from me." And Abraham lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, a ram. And behold, behind him a ram caught in a thicket by his horns. And Abraham went and took the ram and offered him up for a burnt offering in the stead of his son. So there's a couple times here in this story that Abraham uses this this phrase to respond to someone speaking to him. This story, I think, to try to understand something for ourselves, when God called Abraham in this story, it was for a sacrifice. And so there's often calls of sacrifice in our lives. And here, Abraham is called to surrender the most precious thing that he had at this point. Abraham was pretty rich. He could have probably sacrificed a couple hundred sheep, and it would have been much easier for him to do than to take this only son and offer him. The story starts out by saying that God is tempting Abraham, and we don't like to think of that as much as God being like tempting someone, because we usually think of temptation as being something negative that the devil does and to tempt us into doing something evil. And so in this context, it's probably better to think of it as being tested. The other thing that's so interesting about this story to me is that God is also asking Abraham to give up something that he had promised him. Like, this wasn't just any old son, if I can say it that way. This was the son of promise. This was a son that Abraham waited years and years and years and years and years for. And here God is saying, "I want him back, because I want to know if you are actually that loyal to me." And it's really, there's so much going on in this story that's hard to understand, but I think that's the essence of what's happening. Abraham, We know this story well, but one of the things that always impresses us when we read this story is verse 3. Abraham doesn't argue. He doesn't ask for time to go and get ready to do this. He gets up early the next morning and he takes some servants with him, and he takes his son and he takes the wood and he starts on the journey. And he doesn't exactly know where he's going. And this is the second or third time that Abraham didn't know exactly where he was going. He was going to have to wait until God told him. And that's where this comment that I made in Sunday school comes in. One of the things that you notice in this in this story is that Abraham doesn't really get any revelation on what's happening until he takes the first step. I've talked about this story with different people because one of the things that's so astounding about it is that God is adamantly opposed to child sacrifice later in the Old Testament. What's one of the reasons they go into captivity? The children of Israel are punished for child sacrifice. So why is God asking Abraham to sacrifice his son? And one person suggested to me that Abraham already knew what was going to happen. Well, that seems to take pretty much everything out of the story to me. This, to me, makes way more sense to go with the idea that there was some faith that God knew what he was doing and that this sacrifice in some way was going to come back in the future as a blessing and as what God really wanted. And Hebrews gives us a little idea of what Abraham was thinking, and that was that somehow God was going to raise him back from the dead. So in Abraham's mind, Isaac was dead. That's what I believe. And I really think that if you go with the idea that God somehow whispered in his ear that, by the way, it'll be okay, I'm going to not let you kill Isaac, well, then why go through the drama? Like, there's no sense in that to me. So be that as it may, it's just a lot of things to unpack there. But the point I'm getting at is simply this. Abraham did not see the sheep until Isaac was on the altar and ready to die. And that's when the sheep was there. But there was also a call from God again, and Abraham answered in the same way, here am I. And I'm proposing to us this morning, as we think about the call, responding to the call of God, it's going to call to a place of sacrifice, just like it did for Abraham. And also, I believe that the way of faith will only become plain as we walk it. I really believe that. Otherwise, it's not faith. Otherwise, it's just punching it into the GPS and we know exactly what we're going to do. Like, we just know how we're going to get there. But God puts these things in our way and it calls for some astounding sacrifices. And God's outrageous proposal to sacrifice Isaac only resolved when Abraham walked it all the way through. And then it resolved. Then there was an answer. Then there was something that made, I'm not going to say it made sense, but it ended up in a way that Abraham could hardly have expected. That's how I interpret this story anyway. And so for us today, faith only works as we obey. That's what I think. We take the steps. We get up early in the morning. We do what God's asking us to do. And on the third day, we're going to find out what mountain we're supposed to go to. And when we get on the mountain and we build the altar and everything's ready to be the most dramatic thing that we've ever done, then the path becomes clear. And by the way, even though Isaac didn't die in this story, it still remained one of the most dramatic moments in Abraham's life, I would suspect. And in Isaac's. This is two people here that are trusting. And the thing that's interesting here, this is a side, it's not really part of the story, it's not part of the point that I'm making, but it's one of the things that I just feel like I have to point out. Isaac is like the human type of what Abraham's doing. Isaac is, he doesn't know what's going on. He's asking questions. Where's the lamb? And so Abraham gives him this obscure answer that somehow God's going to provide this lamb. And so when they get there and Isaac finds out that he's the lamb, in verse 9, he's bound up and laid on the wood. He knows exactly what's happening, doesn't he? He's seen Abraham do sacrifices before. But he's trusting his father just like Abraham's trusting his father. I think there's something going on there that is worth exploring sometime. But anyway, that's the call of sacrifice. And to us, when God calls us to sacrifice, the The story is teaching us that we open ourselves up with the same response, here I am. And humility and surrender are needed for this to happen. Let's go to Genesis chapter 31 to see the next story of a man responding with these words to God, or a vision of God. It's kind of hard sometimes to always understand what's happening in these stories as far as how God is revealed. But in Genesis 31, we have Jacob. So we're jumping ahead two generations, Abraham and then Isaac and now Jacob. And Jacob is away from home. He is living with his father-in-law. And as we know, Jacob and Laban kind of deserve each other. Jacob wasn't always the most upstanding individual. He tricked his brother a couple of times and tricked his father and did all kinds of things that weren't meant to build healthy relationships, to put it mildly. And Laban tries the same thing on Jacob. And I don't know what all goes on in these stories, but somehow, as Laban is trying to take advantage and take the wealth away from Jacob, Jacob figures out ways around it, or maybe God's working. Well, God is working, of course, but there's some things going on, and it ends up that Jacob seems to always increase more than Laban, and so Laban gets mad. Like, that's the context of the story. The Bible describes it as Laban's countenance is not toward Jacob as it was before. So it means that he's having a hard time accepting the fact that Jacob is prospering. And he now has two of his daughters and most of his herd. And that's the context of this story. So, in verse 10, Jacob is talking to his wives. And he tells them it's about time to leave. And verse 9, he says, God hath taken away the cattle of your father and given them to me. And it came to pass at the time that the cattle conceived that I lifted up my eyes and I saw in a dream, and behold, the rams which leap upon the cattle were ring streaked, speckled, and grizzled. And that was the... He's describing to his wives how God was working to make him wealthier than Laban. And the angel, this is verse 11, and the angel of God spake unto me in a dream, saying, Jacob, and I said, here am I. And he said, this is the angel, lift up now thine eyes. So he's still having this vision, and the angel of the Lord is speaking to him. And he describes how all of the cattle and sheep are going to be ring streaked, speckled, and grizzled. And he's doing that because Laban's trying to take advantage of it. Well, let's go to verse 13. The angel says, and I don't know how to think about all this, but there's an angel, and then also he says, I am. So apparently, in some way, it is God himself. I am the God of Bethel, where thou anointest the pillar, and where thou vowedst a vow unto me. Now arise, get thee out from this land, and return unto the land of thy kindred. So this isn't describing the dream. This is Jacob describing the dream to his wives. If you read the whole story, that's what's happening. And so his wives say, well, we may as well go with you because, well, you have everything. That's kind of what it sounds like. I don't know why. It's just an interesting little thing to think about, but So they leave. That they decide to listen to the dream. And Jacob's response was that we're going to listen to this dream to get out of the land. Now, if you go back to Bethel, Genesis 28, see, God reminds him that he's the God of Bethel. And Bethel is where, in Genesis 28, Jacob is running away from home, and he dreams about this ladder going up to heaven, and so on. And when he woke up in verse 18, he took the stone that he had for his pillows and set it up for a pillar and poured oil upon the top of it, and he called the name of that place Bethel. But the name of that city was called Luz at the first. And Jacob vowed a vow, saying, if God will be with me and will keep me in the way, in this way that I go, and will give me bread to eat and raiment to put on, so that I come again to my father's house in peace, then shall the Lord be my God. And this stone which I have set for a pillar shall be God's house, and of all that thou shalt give me, I will surely give the tenth unto thee. So Jacob there's so much about Jacob that's a little hard to, it's hard to hold him up as a role model, to be honest, because it sounds like he's dickering with God here, right? He's saying things like, if you'll do this for me, then I'll give you a tenth. Well, God takes him up on this deal. That's the thing that's fascinating, for one thing, and reminds him of it in the dream there when he's with Laban. And he keeps Jacob safe. He gives him bread to eat. He gives him raiment to put on. And now he's reminding Jacob of his commitment in this dream. And Jacob responds with the phrase, here am I, or here I am. There's a lot of things I'm not sure about in this, in the way this works, because I would be very hesitant to encourage somebody to do what Jacob did here and say, if you'll keep me safe, I'll do this for you. Like, I would be very hesitant to say that that's a good way to engage with God. So it's hard for me to see that as a good thing. But what it does do is that it shows that God is faithful in reminding us of our commitments. And we should remember that God does hear these vows. And so when we make vows to God, we are not playing games. I think that's one of the things that this teaches us here. And Jacob knew enough to know that. Because when God said, I want you to leave Laban and I want you to go back to the land of your fathers, he didn't act as if he had a choice. He goes immediately to his wives and he says, look, we got to leave, because God's telling me to leave. Things are shaping up so that your father's angry, and so we really should go. And Jacob kept his vow, and so that's commendable. I think Jacob could have ignored this dream. I think he could have. I think he could have rejected it, but he didn't. And so that's the part that we want to focus on. And What else can we learn from this? Well, I'm calling this the call of commitment. Jacob was prospering so much in this land that it could have been tempting, I suppose, for him to stay. But because God called him to leave, he took that step of faith. And from here away, it does seem as if Jacob's life becomes something that you can honor. It's a little rough in the beginning, but as he comes away from this, he deals with leaving Laban, and then he has another dream where he wrestles with God all night, and then he meets Esau, and it seems as if that's the turning point. And he gets his name changed to Israel, which is all very interesting. And that's not really the message. But back to the main point. That is this thing of commitment. God's going to call us to commitment. And I think it takes humility and surrender to remain committed to the call of God on our lives. Whatever that call is, the very basic call of salvation, of course. And, you know, then we make vows, right? When we're saved, we get baptized, we make vows about that. Well, it isn't very long into that journey that we find out that there's tests, and it's going to be really easy to forget that we stood in front of witnesses and said that I am renouncing the world, the flesh, and the devil. It's really easy to forget that we did that, but God's going to bring things into our lives when we commit. He's not going to let us forget those things that easily. Marriage vows, other vows that we make, God will call us to commitment. When we respond with, here I am, we can reject it, we can get hard, we can do those things, but to be of use, to be the kind of people that God will look to, then I think we will remain faithful, and we will open ourselves to that. The next story, Genesis 46. So far, we've looked at the call of sacrifice, the call of commitment. Now we're looking at the call of trust. This is in the context of, well, let me read the verses. Verse 46, 1 to 7. And Israel took his journey with all that he had and came to Beersheba and offered sacrifices unto the God of his father Isaac. And God spake unto Israel in the visions of the night and said, Jacob, Jacob. And he said, Here am I. And he said, I am God, the God of thy father. Fear not to go down into Egypt, for I will there make of thee a great nation. I will go down with thee into Egypt, and I will also surely bring thee up again. And Joseph shall put his hand upon thine eyes. And Jacob rose up from Beersheba, and the sons of Israel carried Jacob their father and their little ones, and their wives and the wagons which Pharaoh had sent to carry him. And they took their cattle and their goods which they had gotten in the land of Canaan and came to Egypt, Jacob and all his seed with him, and his sons' sons with him, and his sons' daughters, and all his seed brought he with him into Egypt. And then it gives a whole bunch of names. Well, what's going on here is, well, we know this story too. Jacob's an old man, and his sons have been going into Egypt, and there's lots of drama around that. And they finally come back and they tell him that Joseph is alive and that he's wanting everybody to come into Egypt. Well, think about Jacob and think about Egypt and think about Abraham and think about Egypt. Egypt has never been a good place for God's people to go. It's always been a bad idea to go to Egypt. People go to Egypt and bad things happen. And it's kind of, I think it's literal, but it's also kind of a type. You'll also notice that they always go down to Egypt. It's never up. It's never a good direction. And so Jacob, I think, while he makes preparations to go and they're on their way, this is a confirmation that he is doing the right thing. But Jacob responds with the same words, Here am I. And God says, It's going to be okay. You're going to go down there and you're going to be I'm going to be with you. What I think we can get from this is that there are times that we are called to walk this journey of life, and it seems perhaps unwise. Now, I want to be careful when I say that, but I think sometimes that's true. That a life of faith will sometimes take us places that don't seem to make sense. And we're going to have this humility and brokenness to follow that. And we're going to act in trust, and we're going to gather our family, and we're going to say, Here am I, and then God's going to be with us. And this trusting journey is one that I think all of God's children need to do it to be fully fulfilled. But I don't know what Egypt you might have to go down to and allow God to work out details, but I think it is going to affect each of us. And while Egypt was a problem later, God was still doing something big. And Jacob never lived to see that. It was just it was an act of faith for him to go down there. And that's just going to be the life that we live sometimes. When we have a call and we answer that call, Here am I, then it's going to take trust to believe that God's going to do what he says he's going to do. And that's a whole message. So I'm just going to move on. It's kind of it's too big of a point to unpack, but we do have to act in trust, and it's going to take humility and brokenness to do that. Just like Jacob, he had to make up his mind that he's really going to do this. He's really going to go to Egypt, because it wasn't obvious that that was a good idea at first. Let's go to Exodus chapter 3. Exodus 3 is a very familiar story. Most of these stories actually are quite familiar to us because, well, they matter And they help us understand something about God, I think. This, "Here am I," is found in verse 4. And this is in the context of Moses seeing the burning bush. I'm not going to read all these verses. We know these passages. And there's, again, lots of things that could be said. But remember the context of this. Moses was sure that he was going to deliver Israel. And you know what he did. You know why he's even here. Because earlier in his life, he went out there and killed an Egyptian. And, of course, this made everybody cross with him. And so he had to run away. So he runs away to the desert. And so for 40 years, he's just wandering around keeping sheep. And while he's doing this, there's a bush that catches his attention. And I don't know if little brush fires were common or not. Didn't really think about studying that. But you'll notice that he saw the fire, but it wasn't until he noticed that the bush wasn't burning up, that it was like it just wouldn't go away. That's when he went over and said, "I'm going to check this out." So it seems to me that maybe seeing a brush fire wasn't all that uncommon. But the fact that this thing wasn't burned up was uncommon. There's a couple of things that we can learn from that, perhaps. One is that God doesn't always do something big. In other words, this isn't a big oak tree that's on fire. This is a little bush. And Moses had to look at it for a while to figure out that it wasn't being consumed, because fires aren't that fast. And so he had to at least look at it a little bit to understand that it wasn't going away. Well, then God calls him to do something. Now, I want you to think about Moses. Moses had already tried to figure out how he's going to let Israel free. Now he's a shepherd, and we know from Genesis that the Egyptians hated shepherds. So now he's being called to go back as an old shepherd who failed when he was the prince, and he's going to confront Pharaoh. That's interesting. But it wasn't until he got to that point that God could actually use him to do something. And so what's going on here? Well, I think this is the call of God's purpose and timing. And I'm going to say that God's call of purpose and timing isn't always immediately obvious. It wasn't very obvious. It seemed obvious when he was the child in Pharaoh's house. That's a position of power. That's a position that you can go and do whatever you need to do. Well, except you can't go murder Egyptians. That you can't do. Now, as a shepherd, what standing does he have to ever hope? And the call of God, while it was exactly what he had hoped to do earlier, suddenly it seemed too big and he felt inadequate to do it. And that's what needed to happen. And that's what needs to happen to us. First of all, we need to take notice of God's work. So the bush, as it were. Moses could have ignored it, I think. I think he could have. If he had, this story would end very differently. But he didn't ignore it. And through that, we have the rest of the story. And Moses needed to take notice of the call. He needed to look at the bush. He needed to hear God. And then he needed to reply with, "Here am I," or "Here I am." And that laid him open to this surrender, this humility, this attitude of being ready to do whatever it was. But then when he found out what the job was, he wasn't so sure. And he wanted to walk it back, but he didn't. And he goes through. And we have an amazing story of a man who then becomes known as one of the men that are the meekest men that ever lived. And there's so much that we could learn from Moses, but the call of God's purpose and timing is something that none of us can, well, if we're serious, we can't ignore it. And we can't make it up. And when we try to do things outside of that, we end up making a disaster of it. All right, the next story, I'm going to combine two responses under the heading of speaking the truth. And so we have a call to speak the truth. But I'm going to put two people under that because I feel like the call is the same for them. And the first one is in 1 Samuel. We know that story of Samuel, a little boy that, I don't know how little he was, but he was young anyway, living with Eli. This is in 1 Samuel chapter 3. And so he's there in this, I guess the tabernacle, with Eli. And he's helping out, doing whatever needs to be done. And he becomes so used to helping Eli that when he went to sleep and he heard someone call him in verse 4, he answers, "Here am I." And it's interesting that he uses that to respond to a man. Now, he doesn't know that this is God. So he's opening himself up as a person of service to Eli. That was what he thought he was doing. He thought he was responding to Eli when he said, "Here am I." And so he runs to Eli in verse 5. And Eli said, "No, I didn't call you, so why don't you go back to sleep?" So he did, and we know the story, how he called a couple of times, and each time he said, "Here am I," and he ran to Eli, and verse 7, we get a little glimpse into what's going on. Samuel did not know the Lord, neither was the word of the Lord yet revealed unto him. And so that's an interesting little information piece. He's living right there. Verse 1 says he's ministering unto the Lord before Eli, but he doesn't know who the Lord is. And I think that just means that he wasn't personally communicating with God at that point. And so God's calling him. And then third time in verse 8, Eli finally figures out that maybe this is God. And so he says what Samuel shall do. Verse 9, he's supposed to ask the Lord to speak. And so then we get this message from God. Before we look at the next person, I want to just think about this. This job that Samuel had was to tell the truth to a man who, well, I don't know what Eli was like. He must have been an okay kind of guy to be around. He probably wasn't really scary because Samuel didn't seem to be afraid of him. But nevertheless, having the job as a young man to tell an older man a terrible prophecy about his children could not be easy no matter what, no matter who the person is. And he didn't want to tell Eli about it, but he did. And Eli accepted it, and of course we know the rest of the story. But one of the other things that I think we can learn here is the way Samuel responded to Eli, I believe, set him up to respond to God properly. I really believe that. And we believe that on a level with children, don't we? We kind of teach that, don't we? That our children are introduced to some concepts about who God is through their fathers and mothers, through earthly authorities. And that's an amazing responsibility as earthly authority. But that's also an amazing responsibility on us who are under authority to recognize that if we rebel against valid human authority, the likelihood of us rebelling against God is pretty high. Now I know that I suppose you could take this whole thing of bowing to human authority, and that's why I put the word valid in there. There are times when people try to use power to make people do things that aren't right, and that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about valid human authority, where God is clearly set a person in authority, and such as parents or something like that. And a child who chooses to rebel against that, I am submitting to you this morning that they are not going to be prepared to hear God. And a parent who refuses to listen to the authorities in their life, whether it's other parents, through the brotherhood, through church, through laws of the land, whatever they are, valid human authority, if we reject, I believe we will also be unprepared to hear God. And the second thing that I want us to think about with Samuel here is that speaking the truth is a call that all people who want to serve God have, but it requires a great deal of humility, brokenness, and submission to always speak the truth. Now, we're commanded to, later in the Bible, he tells us that we should speak it in love, and that's certainly the case, because there are times that it would be nice to speak the truth. But I would suggest that if we're in a mood that we think that we're ready to speak the truth to somebody, that it may not actually be as much truth as we think it is. I tend to think that. I think that that's more just a way to try to demoralize somebody. But here, Samuel was called to speak the truth. Well, there's probably a lot more that could be said, but there's a couple of points there I wanted to cover. Let's go to Isaiah to see another man who was called to speak the truth to a bunch of people that weren't going to listen. We know that. And we know the story. Isaiah 6. Isaiah is having this vision, and he sees these seraphims, and the house fills up with smoke, and he recognizes that he is a man who needs help. He's undone, it says. And he recognizes his inadequacy in the presence of the ultimate reality. But he goes through this thing of being purged with a live coal, and then God says, he hears the voice of the Lord saying, "Whom shall I send, and who will go for us?" And I said, "Here am I, send me." So this is Isaiah, after seeing this tremendous vision, opening himself up, just like Moses, just like Samuel, just like Abraham, using the same phrase, "I'll do it." And what a job. What a job Isaiah signed up for. Well, yeah, it was a job, because notice verse 10, he says, or verse 9, "Go and tell this people, hear ye indeed, but understand not, and see ye indeed, but perceive not." And their heart was going to be fat, their ears heavy, and they were going to shut their eyes because of, you know, it was going to be a terrible thing. And then Isaiah started to have some second thoughts maybe, and he says in verse 11, "How long is this going to last?" And God answers and says, "Until the cities be wasted without inhabitant, and the houses without man, and the land be utterly desolate, and the Lord have removed men far away, and there be a great forsaking in the midst of the land." So anyway, this was a lifelong job, and he knew that his message of truth would likely not be received. There was going to be a group of people that he went and preached to, and they were going to not listen. They were just, and he was supposed to do that until the cities were wasted, until the captivity and so on is what I think he's referring to there. From these two men, we learn that when we open ourselves to God's direction, we may be opening ourselves to the responsibility of speaking the truth. And I'm going to propose that truth is difficult to speak because it leads to at least a certain amount of rejection. And so that's why the temptation is to not speak the truth. But Jesus teaches us that the truth is what sets us free. And that is such a profound statement to think about. Surely in the sense that truth sets us free on a level of salvation, that I think that's one of the most basic levels we think about it. But it also sets us free to operate in a real way. I don't know if you've ever lived this way, and if you haven't, that's an excellent thing, but certainly I've taken my turn doing this, where you try to act in one way in certain situations, and then you try to act another way in other situations, and you try to talk one way in one situation, and you try to talk another way in another situation. That's not freedom. If any of you have ever tried it, you know what I'm talking about. It's not freedom. There's so much bondage in that, because there's so much that you have to try to keep straight. And you never quite know who you are. And until we are ready to accept who we are, and that, again, at the basic level, that would be things like saying, I'm a sinner and I need salvation. That's a very basic one. But then also just in the world that we operate in, if we try to act as if we are somebody that we're not, or we try to say things that we don't really mean, or we try to convey messages that we don't really believe in, there's no freedom for anybody, because, well, you just never know what you're dealing with. And I'm going to suggest to you that there's no freedom in God either, because he can't save you if you refuse to own who you are. I hope that made sense. It makes sense in my head, but I'm not sure if it did when it came out. But anyway, truth sets us free. And so while it may be difficult, it's the most freeing thing we can do for ourselves and for those around us. And it's very practical to speak the truth. People that are, well, you mechanics know what it's like whenever somebody brings something to you and it needs lots of work done. It's probably difficult to tell somebody that their equipment or their vehicle needs a lot of work. But if you pretend like everything's fine except some surface problem, well, that's not honest, and that leads to problems. You can think about that if you're a doctor or a nurse or something, and you try to act like somebody's more healthy than they are. Like, it just gets so obvious whenever we think about it in that sense, but then when we think about it in the sense of spiritual realities, it seems more difficult. Anyway, I'll stop camping out on that. Now, that's all the Old Testament examples. So I realize that when we jump to a New Testament example, that it's not a Greek, it's not a Hebrew word anymore. And so it may not carry the exact same thing, but I find it fascinating that the translation of our Bibles uses the same phrase. And this is in the context of Acts chapter 9. And this is Ananias responding to the Lord in a vision in verse 10. Acts chapter 9, verse 10. And there was a certain disciple at Damascus named Ananias, and to him said the Lord in a vision, Ananias. And he said, behold, I am here. Now, it's all worded differently, but in my Bible, if you're using King James again, you'll notice that the behold and I are both regular type, and the am here is in italics, just like the Hebrew. So I'm kind of going with the idea that it might be similar. Ananias is responding to God's call as the same way the other men in the Old Testament did. He's saying, here I am. What do you want me to do? I'm at your service. And it's interesting to me that all of these men responded with here I am before they knew what the job was. That's something that probably should have pointed out earlier, but if you think about it, that's the way it is. They didn't know what they were up against when they said, "Here I am." And that's one of the other things that is important about this. But Ananias had a tough job. What was his job? The Lord said unto him, "Arise and go into the street, which is called Straight, and inquire in the house of Judas for one called Saul of Tarsus. For behold, he prayeth, and hath seen in a vision a man named Ananias coming in and putting his hand on him that he might receive his sight. And Ananias answered, Lord, I have heard by many of this man how much evil he hath done to thy saints at Jerusalem. And here he hath authority from the chief priest to bind all that call on thy name. And the Lord said, Go thy way, for he is a chosen vessel unto me and to bear my name before the Gentiles and kings and children of Israel. And Ananias, verse 17, went his way and entered into the house and put his hands on him and said, Brother Saul. I think Ananias is a hero in this story. I don't know how much humility and courage it took for him to do what God was asking him to do. Up to this point, nobody knew Saul as anything but a persecutor. Someone to be avoided, somebody to stay away from, somebody that you did not want to find you. And now God is saying, you go there and help him see. Well, wouldn't it be better if the persecutor stayed blind? That would be helpful. You could at least not see. Ananias opened himself to God's call, and he was called to initiate Saul into the community of Christians. I don't know what all to take from Ananias other than the amazing humility, the surrender of his credibility. How much would it have taken for people to misunderstand this? Well, not much. But the lesson I think we can learn from this is that we can expect that answering the call of God in our lives is going to take humility and courage and surrender of things like reputation and credibility. We will have to face misunderstandings, judgments perhaps. It doesn't say that in the scripture. I'm just guessing that there were people that had to work through that, because Saul was Saul after all. But Ananias was the man for the job, and he did it. There's one more passage I want to look at briefly, and I probably should have spent most time on this, but the reason I'm just going to treat it briefly is because it doesn't say, here I am, so it's kind of jumping outside of that theme. But in Hebrews 10, talking about Jesus Christ, in verse 7, there's a prophecy in Psalm that the Hebrew writer brings forward into referring to Christ. And the response that Jesus gave to his Father is in verse 7. Then said I, Lo, I come to do thy will. And I just felt like we couldn't not look at that, because Jesus is the ultimate example of someone who says, here I am, right? And so if coming to God with the answer, here I am, means that we're laying ourselves open to surrender in the ultimate form, the humility, the accepting of God's plan and purpose for our lives, then we have to look at Jesus. We just have to look at him, because he did that. And what did he bear? Well, we can think of all the men that we've been looking at. We can think about Abraham, Jacob, Samuel, Isaiah. They all have a pattern, right? And Jesus illustrates all of those things. He took it all. Rejection, pain, misunderstanding, fear, even death. And when we open ourselves to God as his followers, then we can only expect that there will be at least a certain amount of this in our life. Now, I know that we want Christianity to be a cheerful message, but it sounds like I'm saying it's not cheerful, and that's why I said that. But I want us to understand that the path of hardening would be something that we should maybe think about. Let's suppose, just for very few minutes here, that each of these men, instead of saying, "Here I am," would have said, "No." Well, we wouldn't even be reading the story, because the stories of men that said no aren't recorded here, unless you would count somebody like Esau or count somebody like Pharaoh or somebody like that. But those stories are in there to kind of show us the opposite, I think. And they're very brief. There's not much about Esau, really. There's not that much about Pharaoh. There's not that much about Cain. There's not that much about those people, but the Bible's full of things about men who said, "Yes, here I am." And what I want us to learn from that is that we can expect those things to come into our life when we say, "Here I am." But it is the path of fulfillment. Because the people that said no end up being murderers and blasphemers and just terrible. Like, they live a terrible life, and then we have no hope of anything different in eternity, right? And so it only seems to me that to have true purpose and true meaning and true understanding of what life is all about, that we will say, "Here I am," to God. And I don't know that I can finish up with a lot of practical stuff. I don't know if this is considered a practical message or not. But I believe that God is still calling each person, and he is still, how did Isaiah 66 say it? He is still looking to those who are poor and of a contrite spirit and tremble at his word. And that's what I would call us to today, is that we recognize that it's only through him and his call that there is any kind of filling and any kind of purpose in life. Let's kneel for prayer.